Welcome to the We Are What We Speak podcast. I'm Aaliyah. I'm a filmmaker based in Michigan. I've been interested in language since I was really young and have since studied several languages. I developed an interest in linguistics when I started to understand that analyzing language could tell you so many things about who we are as people, how we navigate the world, and, you know, how we create connections with ourselves and with others.
So my name is Juan Freites. I am a documentary filmmaker, and I've been a culture geek ever since I can remember, and I love discovering stories that are hiding in plain sight, and I think language is one of those things that we use every single day, and it touches every aspect of human life, but we take it for granted. We don't realize how important and how powerful it can be.
Language is such a ubiquitous part of our lives, and we want to share with you all the stories that we get to hear about all the time, the research that we conduct because of this topic being so interesting to us, and the other language-related work and projects that we're doing. We know that there are people out there who will hear these stories and connect with some of the people that we get to have on, and that's super exciting.
Another reason why we decided to do this podcast is because language is power, and being able to name things, it's empowering, and we want to empower our audiences.
Today in conversation with Frida Ekoto, a Francophone writer, literary critic, filmmaker, and professor at the University of Michigan. All right, so welcome to the show. I'm super excited. I know a little bit about you, but for the folks who don't, can you share a little bit about who you are and like what you do?
So I'm Frida Ekoto. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I teach in several departments, Afro-American, African studies, comparative literature, Romance languages. I came to the University of Michigan in 1995. I've been here for a long time.
I will also say that I quite enjoy like your writing. And so I'm hoping we can dive a little bit into some of those things. But before that, I want to note that linguists don't necessarily agree on what language is, right? So this is a really good opportunity for us to contemplate how we would define it. So in your own words, how would you define language?
I see myself as a post-colonial subject. And when you are a post-colonial subject, the issue of language is very complicated. So my country, Cameroon, I was born in Cameroon, a sub-Saharan country. And first we were discovered by the Portuguese, and then colonized by the Germans. My name, Frida, comes from Germany. Mm-hmm. And then after the First World War, there was a treaty. The Germans lost the war, so they divided the country into two. The British and the French took over. So Cameroon is a typical bilingual country. We speak French and English. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in Switzerland, in French-speaking world. I came to the U.S. where I started speaking English. I learned English in the U.S. So the issue of language is complicated because all you hear from the moment you're growing up is that, oh, you don't speak French very well, you don't speak English very well, you don't speak German very well. So you know, the question of language is that it's never your language. Right. So Derrida said, you know, I have one language and it's not even my language. So I feel like that. You know, I feel like I don't have a language. My mother was from the Congo where she spoke Lingala. And I never really learned Lingala. But both parents spoke Lingala. And then my dad was from Cameroon where he spoke so many different languages, because in Cameroon, there are more than 300 different languages. They are not dialects because you have dictionaries. People speak and write those languages. So we learn few of them, but we don't really write those languages down. So I feel like I don't really have a language. I don't own a language. There's nothing like I can identify, this is my language. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, I grew up speaking French mostly. and then came and then German, and I came to the U.S. I learned English, and then I learned Spanish, because these are the two languages that were around me in this country, in this space. And I always feel like these two languages, I'm struggling to speak them still, even though I use them in my writing. So I don't really feel like I have a language. Whenever I write English, I'm struggling. I'm just about to put out my first novel in English. My other novel, I wrote it in French, and it was translated into English. And this one novel I'm finishing right now, I'm writing solely in English. And one of the readers said, this is a good piece of writing, but it still needs lots of work. And the reviewer said, Ekoto is a brilliant writer in French, but she's still struggling with the language. Yes, of course I'm struggling with English. English is not my language. I'm learning how to use it. I've been in this country for a long time, but it's still, you know, the question of fluidity is still, you know, I'm not getting it. I'm working on it. I think I've been working this one novel for 10 years in English, but it's coming. So we shall see now, you know. It's a daily struggle as I'm writing it. So for me, I always feel that I'm confined in within languages. I know many languages. I speak many languages, but I feel like I can never put my ideas out there the way I want them to come out. Mm-hmm. I feel like I don't, you know, I'm always struggling to get the word. There's always something that I cannot get out. And then as a woman as well, you know, I feel like I have to always look for the proper word to put it out. To speak for me is such a struggle. I'm writing a piece that I'm going to talk about in 2 weeks, coming from the inspiration comes from Audre Lorde, who said, I never dreamed that anyone was thinking of me. And the person who sent the prompt said, well, she created her own canon. So I'm also trying to say, where if you think about the canon, is a question of power. I don't think Audre Lorde wanted to talk about power. What she was talking about, she was creating possibilities for LGBTQ plus people to be able to articulate who they are. Not that she wanted to create a canon. She was just courageous enough to put it out. As she said, silence really did not save her, and your silence will not save you.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So there were so many things that I wanted to pull out of that. I mean, do we have a clap button so we can just like, wow. So, I mean, where do I even start? First of all, one thing I really like about Audre Lorde, and I sort of think about this all the time, is she said, like, anything I accept about myself cannot be used against me to diminish me. One thing that I thought about was you said that for you, language is a hostile place. Franz Fanon said, like, when you speak someone else's language, you're also reproducing those ideologies, whether or not you, like, personally believe them. Can you just talk a little bit more about, like, what that's been like? It is still a struggle. That much you've made clear. Like, how does your language experiences compare from, like, childhood to today?
Yeah, because, you know, today we're talking about decolonizing the mind. We're talking about decolonizing languages. We're talking about decoloniality.
Yeah.
So you can't really talk about decoloniality when you're still using the masses' tool. You know, Frantz Fanon said to speak French, for example, is to reproduce the ideology of the French, because you're using the syntax. You're using the syntax that allows you to speak like a French person, right? So when you're doing that, you are just clearly reproducing the same way that the French use that power to dominate you. You know, if you could change that, it would be great, but you can't, right? The first thing they say is that, but you are not speaking French. You're speaking you know, Creole or something else, right? So, or you're speaking petit French, petit français, right? So then you, of course, you have to speak clear French. You have to speak, use the syntax the same way they want you to speak. So decoloniality for me really is to speak differently, to articulate the sentence, but you cannot, right? Every time I write, a piece, I send it to France, they're like, well, why are you using these names, these African names? Can you use French names? That it starts with that, right? Why do you want me to use French names, right? Can I even bring my difference, a little bit of who I am, into the syntax I'm using? No, you want me to reproduce the syntax. You want me to reproduce even the names of characters I'm using, the French names. Why can I use even the African names, right? To like show that I'm different? No. Right. So that's what I'm talking about. Wow. So from the moment I was born, I'm speaking your language the way you want me to speak it. When I change it a little bit, you say, no, you are not speaking French properly. Speak French.
Properly.
Yeah. Speak unquote. French, quote unquote. They use the N word.
You know?
Right. Yeah. So these are the issues, right? So that's when Ngugi wa Thiong'o in Decolonizing the Mind, he said, what about just writing our own literature in our own African languages, right? Then, if need be, we translate that back to the dominant languages. But first, we have to write those, words into our African languages. I think when Zora Neale Hurston, when she was writing, using folk, when she the language of the South, she was also very much blamed because she was writing that way, because they wanted her to write in clear English syntax. She said, no, I'm writing for my people in the South, right? And today she's the one who's being read left and right because she wrote that way, because she knew what she was doing. She didn't want to reproduce English the way they wanted her to reproduce it, right? Because she knew what she was doing. So we still have this like the Shakespearean experience, yes, of writing, and writing differently. It is always like, but are you writing English? Are you writing French? Are you writing German? Yes, I'm writing French. I'm writing German, but differently. I'm writing the way I understand it. Can you allow me to write it differently? No. It's always, I want you to write it the way the master writes it. That is a problem.
Yeah, I just want to specify, for those who don't understand, in the United States, that particular ideology of speak proper is specific to English, yeah, right? And so it's insidious because it's not just this, can you use the French name? It's not just a matter of speak proper in order to assimilate. It's more than that, it's deeper than that. And so there are consequences beyond internalized violence. There are real world consequences, right? So I just wanted to sort of point that out for those who are what do you mean? Just write proper. No, it's on the surface. Anyway, I just wanted to pop that in. Juan, do you have anything?
No, I mean, I have a lot of things, but because one of the reasons why I felt compelled to work on this project is because I also felt confined. My native language is Spanish. And when I came to the U.S., then I was asked, you need to speak the proper language to be able to get a job or to write a paper or even to communicate. You're not communicating well, so you need to communicate the way the masters want you to communicate. And so I can relate because I have felt confined for a very long time. And I think this project has allowed me to explore, to open up and be like, we need to talk about these things because these things are happening right now. And I mean, that's one of the things that I was thinking about. Then you were talking about, how you speak different languages, but you don't feel like you have your own language sometimes. And remember that concept we were talking about with Savi, one of the professors at U of M, of languagelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that as well, because I have been in this country for 23 years now, and a lot of times, I have lost some of the Spanish words because I speak English every day. And so I feel in this in-between places of I don't speak proper English, but I'm losing some of my Spanish. And so there is this limbo that I find myself in. And I don't know if you feel the same way sometimes, but I'm And I couldn't find a name for it until we talked with the professor at U of M and she had a name for it. And I was like, oh my God, yes, I feel that. I do feel that way. So,
yeah, that's, I just like, that's really cool. Like one element of this project, just helping people name some of the things that are like at play in these everyday situations. One of the sort of things that I want to think about a little bit is like the idea of linguistic prestige, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things Savi also talked about this, this idea that, you know, multilingualism, depending on where you come from and what you look like and whether or not you have invested money in it, is a quality to be celebrated, right? But this idea that, oh, you know these languages because they were given to you by your parents, suddenly it shifts. There's this like difference in experiences. So I'm interested in your thoughts on like linguistic prestige and like how some people get celebrated for speaking different languages and while others still experience like marginalization because they speak different languages.
Yeah, I mean, immigrants, for example, mm-hmm. speak many languages, but do they talk about prestige when it comes to them? Do they even acknowledge that they do speak those languages? No, you know, because they are immigrants, you know. They come with them, you know, they just bring them, you know, they just carry them in their bags.
Yep.
You know, they just have to, they hop up, they come from here, they go there, and they just learn those languages because they have to survive, right? And then people that go to universities here, they, you know, they go to La Sorbonne and here and there in Paris, in Germany, and they learn. Then they're like, okay, I went to Paris and I learned French. So, you know, that's mm-hmm. a prestige, right? So I think it's the way we look at, you know, these people and talk about the prestige, right? Mm-hmm. The mere fact that, first of all, you go to university to begin with is already prestigious, right? The space you find yourself in is already very prestigious, right? You know, I remember when I went to Colorado College, it's a small college. Yeah. In Colorado Springs, in the mountains there. And people kept asking me, your parents must be very rich. You know, your parents must... And I kept saying, no, my parents are not rich. It just so happened that, you know, I found myself in this space, you know. And I had a scholarship, right? You know, and the student kept asking me, so how much money do your parents have? How did you find yourself in this space, right? I had to like constantly explain, you know, where I came from, how I found myself in this space to begin with. It was not just a given that I was there. Mm-hmm. I had to like explain how I found myself in this space to begin with, you know. So, and how come you spoke French? And I was also accused of trying to speak differently because I wanted to be different. And it was really painful for me because I was trying to learn English. And I was like, and I remember I had this professor who was my mentor, this philosopher, who spoke, he was a Jewish man from New York. He's the one who mentored me. And he spoke many languages because he was a very serious philosopher. And it wasn't until last year I realized, you know, I kept saying, I want to master English. And he kept telling me, no, you don't want to master English. What you want to do is to master your own language. And I never really understood what he meant by your own language. I think what he was trying to tell me, I only understood it last year at this age. What he was trying to tell me was that what I understood, again, reading Toni Morrison and Audre Lorde, what mm-hmm. he was trying to tell me is that you need to acquire your own grammar, your own vocabulary. How are you going to write to make your voice heard outside yourself? It wasn't clear to me because I could not understand what he was telling me. You need to have your own language. Like, what is it that you want to tell the world about you? It was, you know, that's what he was trying to tell me. He kept telling me, you can do that in French, you can do that in German, Spanish, or your African languages. What you need to do is have your own language. And last year I started writing my memoir and it struck me and I was like, ah, This is what he was trying to say to me, right? And so it suddenly went bam. This is what Harvey was saying. And I remember also he was telling me, he spoke so many languages, and he understood. He said, because the kids were making me feel stupid because I couldn't speak English. And they were making me feel like I was just inventing the fact that I could not speak English because I was black, and they felt that I was an African-American. I didn't want to be an African-American. And I kept saying, no, I came from the continent of Africa. I grew up in Switzerland. It was such a struggle. Right? I spent 4 years explaining myself over and over and over and over. So all these struggles, again, they have to do with the way you speak, with the way you present yourself, with the way you articulate your ideas, with the way language comes out of you. Language. That's what I talk about, how language for me is hostile terrain.
I just need there to be a little bit of silence. Because that was deep. Having a mentor, because it sounds like simple, right? Have your own language. It sounds simple. Like, did you experience like relief when you're like, oh, I get it. Now that you get it, what has opened up, right? Like, is it easier now? Have you found your own language?
Yes. Yes. You know, yes. I mean, what he wanted me to do is to have my voice, to be able to speak freely, to say whatever I have from inside. And I think that's what people like Audrey Lorde were doing, to speak what you have inside you. And it's not easy. And it just doesn't come like that. Because you have all this constraint, all this garbage, all these things that like keep you down and you cannot speak freely.
Wow.
Yes. I can speak. You know, yeah.
I've actually been working on the same thing, trying to find my voice because this project has helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I've been working on, it's shame, right? It's the shame that you have that pushes things down. And it's like, because I don't allow myself to say whatever I want to say because I have to say proper. I'm doing the air quotation.
Yeah.
But I understand. I'm also in that struggle of trying to find my voice. But I feel the liberation little by little. And it's amazing. So
it is. Yeah. It's really profound. You know, the ability to say who you are, the ability to express some of these things that like really have kept you like down. I wrote a piece on shame because of, you know, it's so profound. I wanted to understand what was keeping me like confined, you know, yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
I want to read that piece on shame because that's what I'm working on.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Like something that comes up for me is like legitimacy. Mm-hmm. When I'm thinking, like, I grew up speaking, I mean, English, and I didn't start exploring different languages until like a little bit later. And one thing that wasn't clear to me at the time, because, right, language and linguistics is different, right? And so what I was interested in was language, and I became interested in linguistics later. And when I started studying linguistics, like, Black English, its treatment, the way it's perceived, the legitimacy of it as a quote-unquote real language was suddenly... I was so much more aware of it. There was a book, I mean, not Zora Neale Hurston, but there was another book, I think like Palm Wine Drunkard, was like a really interesting example. And suddenly I'm like, oh, there's different Englishes. Mm-hmm. There's not just proper mainstream English, which by the way, it's chosen. Like it shifts, it changes. And so like when you start to understand that languages change, suddenly you can see the edges of this like manufactured thing. And so sometimes thinking about like the legitimacy of our language, I'm suddenly able to say, it's like understand like my legitimacy as a person is an extension of whether or not my language is acceptable to, you know, those in power, I'll say it that way, right? Yeah. Those who've decided which English is valuable and whose language is valuable, right? And so anyway, so just hearing you talk, I think about legitimacy. Like, how do you grapple with this lack of recognition of your humanness because of the oppression of your language, right? You're told, go find your own language, and suddenly something opened up for you. And yet there are still going to be people who are imposing their ideas of what legitimate discourse, legitimate language, and language use even is.
I mean, that's the whole question of oppression, how oppression functions. You know, how do you deal with the fact that you are not seen, and you may never be seen ever, regardless of what you say or what, you know. You can scream all you want, they will never see you because of the structure of how things have worked so far. That's what I was saying, that, you know, like, the reason why I studied also, I'm working on trying to write in English, because I'm sick and tired of sending my work in France where they're supposed to publish. It's like they always come up with excuses because they don't want to publish the way I write, for example, right? I mean, I think I was the first African woman who wrote a whole novel about LGBTQ plus issues. They're like, okay, well, how do you justify that? African women don't write about that. I'm like, listen, I'm human, right? You know, and I have a sexuality too. Hello. So you can't tell me what I can write on. So these are the questions, right? How, you know, they dictate who you are, what they want you to do, and how they want you to do it, you know? So you have to keep forcing and forcing and forcing, you know? So I'm like, okay, I'm tired of that. I'm just going to, you know, switch.
We'll see what happens.
Because even if I write in English, maybe then they will do the movement, they will translate it into French then.
This makes me think of, so I saw this clip, Ousmane Sambène. He was replying to a question about, like, the reception of his film work in Europe. Yeah. And he's like, well, he rejected this idea that his work should center Europe.
What? Are you kidding me?
I saw that. Yeah. And I really like that, because it's this idea that you need to create for this conglomerate almost. Yeah. And he's like, no, they're not the center of my world. I am. And I interpret that as, like, Senegal is.
Est-ce que vos films sont bien compris en Europe?
Non, mais mettons-nous bien ça dans la tête. Moi, l'Europe n'est pas mon centre. L'Europe est une périphérie de l'Afrique. Vous voyez? Ils sont restés plus de 100 ans chez moi, ils n'ont pas parlé ma langue, je parle leur langue.
He said, Africa is the center. I am the center, not them. I mean, ideas like that. He used to fight with them all the time. They hated him.
Yeah.
And he hated them. So, you know, but he made films. So.
Yes.
You know, that's, I mean, the thing is that we don't have many Ousmane Sambènes around anymore. So we need a little more of the Ousmanes coming around, you know. And it's difficult because, you know, they still have the power to, like, you know, crush you. And but regardless, right, so. Yeah.
Yeah, I highly recommend. Like, I feel like one of the first films I saw was actually in your class. I'm pretty sure it was Black Girl.
Yeah.
1966. Check it out. But other films of his, Mulata,
Fatkinen,
Shero, like, go check them out. Like, some of the counter narratives that he, like, presents in those films. I mean, beyond, like, language, because, like, he's also someone, if you want an example of, like, linguistic celebration.
You know what he did? For years and years, he refused to have his film translated into any language. All his films were in Wolof. I remember I went to Senegal to interview him. I said to him, so people need to see. He's like, why should I care that they don't understand my films? My people are making this film for Senegalese. He said, you know, do you want to understand them? I said, yes. He said, well, too bad. Then learn Wolof, you know.
Yes.
He was just unbelievable.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
I know.
That's like, just that sounds amazing. Because something that you say sometimes is like, I speak my language and your language. Why can't you speak mine?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's the energy that he brought all the time. Like, because he was saying in that same interview, he was like, in 100 years, they haven't learned my language.
No, yeah, he said, you know, so I speak French, I speak Wolof, I speak English, all these other languages. When are they going to learn my language?
When? I mean, come on. There's books. But like, there's no excuse at this point. So anyway, yes. He's on fire.
He's on fire. He was on fire.
Yes.
You're making me think because, so what? When I moved to the U.S., I think it was like the first year that I was in the U.S., so I asked, you know, a guy, like, who are the founding fathers, like, that they keep talking about? And he was like, wait, you don't know? Like, with looking at me with this, like, are you stupid that you don't know the founding fathers? And I was like, do you know the founding fathers of Venezuela? And he was like, no. So I'm supposed to know the founding fathers of the U.S. because that's the rule. And it's just, I was just thinking about that because, you know, the thing about learning, you haven't learned my language. Why do I have to learn yours?
Exactly.
Or translate my work into yours?
The way we function, the center is always the center, right? You know, Toni Morrison, you know, she wrote One Moves in the Margins, right?
Yes.
So for her, is that what she's trying to say is that, you know, I write from the margins because actually I write from the history of what happened to Black people. That's all she's trying to say. She's not trying to say that, you know, I'm decentering the center. No, she said at the margin is where that history is located. That's what she's trying to say. Mm-hmm. And that's what she's writing. And you know, once you understand that, you see what she's doing. And when people kept asking, are you going to have white characters? She's like, no, I'm not interested in white characters. I'm interested in I'm writing for Black people because I want them to understand what happened to them. And this is where they are, at the margin, that's where they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the center should stay where it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm moving from the margins, that's where they are,
mm-hmm.
you know. Simple as that. You know? So,
I like that. I like that. I like how it's disruptive, but like it such a simple thing is such a big threat.
Yes.
And I like how maybe from a safe distance, it's like dangerous. How do we move dangerously?
Yeah, how do we? That's what, you know, that's the Caribbean writer, Edwige Dantica, she wrote about that, writing, you know, dangerously. It's like, she's like, how do we move dangerously in our writing? That's what she wants to say. She says that, you know. She's another writer. She's super interesting, the way she uses language as well. Edwige Dantica, you know. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to take a step, maybe a little bit towards what you were saying, Juan. Like, because I think part of all this is about, you know, back to like assimilation, right? What does that bring up for you? Like that word.
Assimilation?
Mm-hmm.
God, that's a word I don't like.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because I don't know why it was embedded in my brain. When I moved here, automatically I assume I have to assimilate. So I have to act like these people to be allowed to exist in this society, and that's been a struggle that I, you know, and like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I was just like, no, why are you making me feel less? Like, I speak, you know, 2 or 3 languages, and you're making me feel less than you. So it's been that struggle that I started to peel the onion to get to the center of things, and That's how I feel. It's a struggle, but we're going in the right direction, I think. And this project is, you know, proof of that.
Peel the onion, guys. We must peel it. What about you?
I like that, peel the onion. No, but there's you know, there's, yeah, that. You know, the other day, you know, we were talking about the writing style, you know, my colleagues, you know, the way the French write, the way the German write, the way, you know, even that, you still have to write like how Americans write. Mm. I don't write like Americans. I don't think like that, you know. So that also is a struggle. You know, I mean, I was trained as a philosopher. You know, when you ask me a question, I have my own way of rambling around it. But I think my rambling says something. So you have to have the finesse to understand what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. You know, and you should open your mind and listen to what I'm saying, but not force me to speak like you. That's another thing. So I think I also feel this kind of isolation, even from my colleagues, because they never understand what I'm trying. They say, "Oh, it's too complicated what she's saying." It's not complicated. It's because they don't want to open up. You know, they don't want to want me to even isolate in the way they think. I don't think that way. I don't think that way. You know, they ask me small questions and I start going off somewhere.
Your eyes like glaze. Like, because I think a little bit of like cognitive load, right? Like, I think people are worth it, right? Worth the effort of understanding each other. Mm-hmm. It's effort. It's effort. But I guess my point is people are worth the effort. So my question is, in your opinion, what is like the responsibility that we have to each other to communicate?
We have to learn to listen to each other. I mean, the question also, I think there's one thing that is missing here is that we don't make an effort to listen to the other to begin with. Generally, not even linguistic, to listen to the other. So the within the encounter, when I meet you, I have to take time to listen to what you have to say to me. You know, we don't even make that effort anymore. To listen, we have to learn to listen to the other. We don't do that anymore. You know, we just like walk by and then it's like, what did they say? We don't listen. The responsibility for me is to learn to listen. You know, there's this philosopher, the social critic, he's the one who coined a cultural critique, Stuart Hall. You know, Stuart Hall talks about the responsibility of listening to each other. He used to come here and teach. I remember in the 90s, he used to come with his wife. I used to go to his seminars and then I would follow them around and then I would go have lunch with him. I would just sit there, listen to him. He would sit and listen to people. And somebody wrote an essay about how he was like the listener. You need to listen. Mm-hmm. Today, I think people, they just talk and talk. They don't listen.
All right, I'm jealous again. First of all, you had lunch with Stuart Hall. I heard that. Like, anyway,
he was incredible. He was so humble too. Mm. I mean, I think you know, you meet those great minds. And just so calm, so giving, so, you know. Yeah, I was telling a colleague of mine today, I said, I just want people to start learning to listen again. I was saying this today.
It's an art, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that. I would love to, like, become a very, very good listener. Mm-hmm. I feel pressured to like say things sometimes that I don't have to say. I just want to take my time, calmly sit down, sit back, and listen.
More with Frida in part 2.